the top again. I've just got time for one more round. Set 'em up, my friend.
All Marine Radio continues, and for the second time, you're going to hear the voice of Chad Buckle. And you heard him talking about a pretty unique concept relative to training infantry Marines, and almost kind of revolutionizing the MOS with a training pipeline that is vastly different than I think what we've grown accustomed today, so accustomed to over the course of years. Today, what you're going to hear is us talk about a couple more articles, and the first one we're going to talk about is a career path. And so, Chad, first of all, thanks for doing this. Welcome back to All Marine Radio.
Hey, it's a pleasure and an honor to be back.
All right. So, yeah, you couldn't have screwed up too bad the first time if you get back the second time.
You know, it's either that or your listeners just haven't kicked down the gate and burned a picture of me in effigy having you on the radio. So
just,
we'll see what happens.
Just stop. Make them go away. All right, again, in 120 seconds, give everybody your career path through the Marine Corps to date.
Enlisted, did reserve enlisted time until about 05 when I graduated college. OCS, IOC, off to 1-6, into Iraq, came back, into Afghanistan, came back, and Saudi Arabia, did a year there advising. From there, ended up at Etsy Range, working with marksmanship. From there to MCCC out at Fort Benning, then out to 3-3 in Hawaii to be the assistant OPSO, then a company commander, then the OPSO, and then up to 3rd Marine Regiment to do some OPS stuff up there. And from there came to where I am now, out in Belgium, doing NATO soft things.
All right, and tell everybody about the series of articles that you've written for the Gazette, because that's what we're kind of working our way through. It's infantry-centric, so not that All Marine Radio leans to be infantry-centric, but it does. So tell everybody about the series of articles you've written. First of all, why'd you write, and then tell everybody about the different articles you've written.
So, after my officer time and company command time, I kind of took a look at the MOS and took note of some gaps that I thought existed, both in how we train, how we man, and how we equip. And I decided to sit down and write about those in a series of essentially 6 articles to spark a conversation within the organization on how we can do better, how we can make some changes, and be better postured for the next fight.
And if you haven't heard the first in this series of discussions, all you got to do is log on to All Marine Radio, go to the podcast page, there's a search box, and you'll see an article entitled "Rethinking the Infantry Pipeline, Major Chad Buckle, USMC." Click on that, and it'll take you to the first interview. So the second article in the series is what?
So it's talking about the career path.
All right.
So as you said, the first article, we talk about how we're going to initially train that Marine and initially train that infantry Marine. Now we're going to talk about the career path and how we do talent management and how we continue to develop that Marine and make him into that superb small unit leader that we are craving for right now in the fleet.
You know, and again, it's interesting. We just interviewed Captain Joe Patterson, who is Kilo 3-5 and a principal, Kilo 3-5, the company that was initially used in Sea Dragon 2025, proven, you know, the concepts of the future rifle squad, blah, 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 blah. And very enlightening, you know, the technology, the demands there on a squad leader, the 0365 MOS, you know, who should be the squad leader. You know, it certainly, in my opinion, can't be a junior. I mean, it may be on occasion a junior sergeant, but he better be exceptional because the demands, you know, and the things that are at his disposal are pretty substantial. And so it's very interesting in light of our conversation about the enlisted infantry training pipeline to see, you know, hey, this is where this is going. So a natural kind of segue into today's topic. So so give us the major thesis of the article.
So essentially, what we have to understand is that look around our society. Every professional organization, whether it be sports, whether it be medicine, whether it be law, whether it be the military, every professional organization has one thing in common. And that is that if you are a high-performing organization, the individual is completely invested in that organization, and in return, that organization is 100% invested in the person. So look at an Olympic sports team. All right, we just got through the Winter Olympics, and look at some of those athletes. You know, every single one of those athletes that won medals, they have dedicated their life to that sport, and they have trained hard, and they have studied, and they have sacrificed for that sport. But in return, that sport has provided training opportunities, world-class facilities, the best coaches, the best medicine. It has invested in that athlete. So it's a symbiotic relationship between the individual and the organization that brings upon that champion mindset. NFL, MLB, hockey, you name it. It's a very common thread. We see it in our Ivy League schools. We see it in our research facilities. We need to see it in the Marine Corps. That is essentially the thesis of this. How do we best find the talent, recruit the talent, and then completely invest into the talent, knowing that the talent will completely invest into the organization so that we drive each other to be better?
What you're describing is certainly something that's never existed in the Marine Corps. We've always kind of prided ourselves. We can... Let's see, how does the saying go? We've been doing something. Oh, God. I can't remember. We've been doing a lot with not so much, you know, for a long time. So we could do something with nothing forever.
I know the quote. I can't.
Right. And it's you know, it focuses on our frugal nature, the way, you know, we make our money last longer, and all those things that are considered virtues in the Marine Corps. You're talking about a change of mindset in all of that a little bit. So,
to an extent, but I don't want to, you know, this idea is not meant to kill the indomitable spirit that we get from our Marines. It's not meant to, you know, make automatons. It's not meant to take away initiative or take away that can-do attitude with almost nothing. What it's meant to do is to unleash it. I think it was Patton who said that, you know, untutored courage is useless in the face of informed bullets, some along those lines.
Right.
I'm probably misquoting the hell out of them.
Right.
But what he was getting at is that, you know, if you don't train your people and they're idiots, and I'm not saying our current force are idiots, but if you don't train them and they're not as prepared as they can be, and they're not as informed, they're not as educated, they're not as well trained, then you're leading them to slaughter. And in today's battlefield, as you know, as we've seen through time and through history, it's getting more lethal, and it will always get more lethal. It will continue to get more lethal, and we have to become better trained, as we have throughout our history.
All right, let me ask you a general question, Chad, and that is the balance point between all these separate requirements. We're going to talk about the infantry career path and delivering somebody that's more lethal. in terms of enabling that, if you have a vision, is it simply a function of money that the Marine Corps has got to make money decisions that put emphasis on this, and that with personnel decisions that support this? What's the long pole in the tent in terms of making ideas like this real?
So yes, absolutely, it is a function of money, but that is only one function. Obviously, an organization invests in what it believes in, and the way organizations in the world today invest is through money, right? You buy resources, whether that's buying talent, whether that's buying things, whatever. So this will cost money, absolutely. It's how we want to prioritize that money. It's how we want to prioritize that resource. That will become a question for the bean counters and become a question for the decision makers. Because if you take a dollar away from a widget and put it towards training, that's great for the training, but not so good for the widget. So you have to decide what's going to define your organization through the way you resource it. But I think more importantly, it's a function of culture. You're right. As Marines, and you said it with the quote, you know, we pride ourselves on being able to do so much with so little. And that is a great strength of our Corps, because when we are cut off or when we are facing long odds, we're used to dealing with less, so we're able to adapt better. But that doesn't mean that we should automatically handicap ourselves in the hopes of, you know, Don Bassalone will rise from the grave with Jesse Fuller and lead the charge. What we should be doing is taking a look at, as we have in the past, take a look at our operating environment, take a look at our threats, take a look at the mission sets that we're being asked to do by the nation, and then decide what type of warrior do we need to invest in and create to put within that operating environment to execute those missions and to go to the places the nation needs us to go, and then unleashing that guy who is better trained and better equipped, better educated, to then improvise and think of the most creative ways of bringing absolute violence to our enemies. And I think that's what it comes down to, is invest in the controlled environment, mold the weapon, and then unleash the weapon. And that's what we're calling for.
Okay. And all that makes sense. And again, the Marine Corps has changed relative to, I mean, when the whole Mojave Viper, the whole enhanced Mojave Viper, the construction that went into training facilities, the hiring of live actors to, you know, so that people could get reps before we went. So the Marine Corps, I mean, has certainly made changes in the way they've trained in the last decade alone, has done things that, you know, I'd never seen done in my lifetime. So it's not like the Marine Corps doesn't listen. Walk us through the infantry career path. When you're talking about training warriors that are this skilled, how does the career path change from what we know today?
So the first thing we start with is the GT score, and that's important. Right now, for riflemen, the GT score is set at 80. And for a critical skills operator, MARSOC, it's set at 105. So within the 03XX population, we have a GT score of 80 to 105. Now, why are GT scores important? Technology, you know, the technology of the infantry has always been the rifle. Well, that technology is now changing. The rifle's still there, but now you have this computer on your back that we call a radio that, yeah, you can call someone, but you can do 1,500 other things with it to enhance your capability on the battlefield. We have drones. We are asking our squad leaders to be able to call for fires and coordinate maneuver at the same time. We're asking them to use tablets. We're asking them to use all kinds of other technical things, and not just technical things that they do at home with their phone, but to do it while sleep-deprived, hungry, stressed, and under fire. So that takes a certain level of cognitive ability and a certain level of skill to be able to start molding from. So what we're saying is, you know, let's set this bar and make it a flat 100, and, you know, make sure we get the right cognitive skill capability into the pot. Put the right ingredients in, you know, the soup comes out well.
Okay.
So last article we talked about taking our training pipeline and turn it into an entire year. Now, to do that, you got to put the Marine into a five-year contract. So that's the second thing we're going to change. If you're going to go infantry, you're going to make that decision with the recruiter, and you're going to be a five-year contract. That way you have a solid year to train, and we still get that Marine, that talent, for 4 years in the fleet, which is critical to our rotational plans. So we maintain the numbers we need in the fleet, and we maintain the experience. Put them through basic training, and then you put them through what we talked about, the entry-level pipeline, during the last discussion. That's the first year. The next thing we're going to change is we're going to pay these Marines more. So right now in the aviation community, they have aviation incentive pay. And what that is designed to do is to keep very, very well-trained and highly qualified pilots flying for the Marine Corps and not flying for Boeing or flying for Delta or flying for whoever. We want to keep them in the Marine Corps. So we invest all this money in these pilots. We train them up. We need to keep them, which means we need to pay them more. We need to do the same thing for the Marines, for the infantry. You give them that incentive pay, but you tie gates. You tie requirements to that. So when they graduate SOI, they become eligible for this incentive pay. They will enter the fleet, and they will begin their workup and go through their first deployment. The next gate will be their MOS-specific advanced school, whether that's advanced mortars, advanced infantry course, whatever. If they don't pass that school, they lose the incentive pay, and they're not eligible to be promoted to corporal. So now we're going to tie experience, we're going to tie school, and we're going to tie performance via their pros and cons to promotion. So now we're going to start, that's where that investment starts really coming in, where the individual has to decide, hey, I'm going to put forth 100% effort, and I'm going to commit to the Marine Corps, and I'm going to meet these gates, and at the same time, the institution is going to be investing more money in me, they're going to invest more training in me, they're going to invest more time in me to develop me. And that's where we start getting that symbiotic relationship.
Okay, let me go back. In terms of GCT score or GT score, what should the minimum be for an infantryman?
So right now, 100 is kind of the middle line, and that's what our scout snipers are rated at.
Right.
Now, when you look at a GT score, it's word knowledge plus paragraph comprehension plus arithmetic reasoning plus mechanical comprehension. So
does that test support our requirements in this case?
I don't know if I am 100% qualified to comment as to whether the test is the right test.
Okay.
But if I look at word knowledge and paragraph comprehension, there's your orders process. I look at arithmetic reasoning and mechanical comprehension. That's dealing with your equipment, dealing with your weapons, dealing with weight. You know, so it on the surface, it seems appropriate, but I don't know if I'm the right guy to answer that question.
All right, so unquestioned in terms of whether it's appropriate or not, but seems to lend itself as a solid tool to do this evaluation. Okay.
Absolutely.
All right. Keep going.
Okay. So we talked about lengthening the tour. We talked about expanding the entry-level training. We talked about developing the first set of gates. So what we're going to seek to do is a private shows up to the fleet. He has been through a year of training. He is better trained now. He's had time to grow and be mentored and to learn. and he's going to go through his first workup and deployment.
Right.
Okay. He's probably a Lance Corporal at this point. He comes back. We send him to one of his advanced schools. He's got to pass. He doesn't pass. Incentive pay goes away, and prospects for promotion go away. He passes that. He's eligible to be a corporal. Now we can start working this Marine into a team leader. Or, as we get into the 15 Marine Rifle Squad, we can work him into an assistant squad leader if he's really that bright shining star. Or we can work him into a designated marksman, and we'll talk about that with the next article. He does another deployment. We're coming up on year four now, right?
Yes.
And that's where we're going to hit gate number two. When he gets back from that second deployment, he's got about a year left on his contract, and he's going to make a decision. I'm either going to go the squad leader route, I'm going to go do other things in the Marine Corps, or I'm going to get out. He goes and does other things in the Marine Corps, four-year reenlistment. He can go be a drill instructor, can go recruiting, go to embassy, do whatever he wants, DOD, whatever. If he wants to get out, he's got a year. We can send him off to the FAP program, and we can properly give that Marine time to work his transition into the civilian world. We owe it to the Marine at that point. He's done two deployments. Let's make sure we build that time in instead of sending him home early from deployment and rushing him through it because we're trying to squeeze all the juice out of this Marine. That's not fair to the Marine. Or what we really want him to do is say, yes, I'm going to go the squad leader route. And if he says that, he's going to enlist again 5 more years. Now remember, he's got a year left on his first contract, and we're going to add 5 to that. So that is a total of 6 years that he's recommitting to. The last year on his first enlistment will be spent in training again. So we trained him up front for a year. Now we're going to train him on the back end for a year. And there's some very specific programs that we're going to want to put this Marine through. So first off, we want to send him to the Infantry Small Unit Leaders course. All right. Right now, that's currently at about 6 weeks. This pipeline would push it up to 9. Give a little bit more time to work those small unit leader skills. We're going to put him through the sergeant's course. We're going to put him through the Marine Corps instructor trainer course, which is 9 weeks long. The force fitness instructor course, 5 weeks long. The martial arts instructor's course, 3 weeks long. And the small arms weapon instructor's course, 8 weeks long. Total of 34 training weeks. All right, 8.5 months. Now, if you notice, it's all the instructor courses that have to do with either close combat, weapons, or teaching, which is exactly what we want our squad leaders to be. Close combat experts, weapons experts, and able to teach so they can train the squad. So we're going to invest 8.5 months of training time, a total year calendar, to giving this Marine additional MOSs and giving this Marine additional skills and allowing this Marine to practice in multiple environments over multiple repetitions how to teach, whether it's how to teach a hip throw, how to teach marksmanship, or how to teach clearing a room. And we're going to work it and work. And he's going to do this with his peer group. So now we're taking these squad leaders and we're building a peer group. So when they go out to the fleet, when 3-3 is on the left flank of 1-6, you know, first squad leader of second platoon and first squad leader of third platoon have worked together, even though they're from two different battalions. And now we're starting to actually build implicit communication at the small unit level across the Corps. So there's a lot of intangible benefits to this model. Once that Marine goes through the training pipeline, he's going to go to one of the schools of infantry for 3 years. And he's going to instruct. And we talked about that model in the last article of how that rotation would work, where he would first take a squad in the class and then eventually move on to more specialized stuff towards the end of his tenure. So now we've taken this Marine. He's been through two deployments. He's been through an advanced course that made him into a team leader.
Right.
And then served as that team leader. And he's been through a year more of training.
Right.
Now he's instructed his skill sets for 3 years. He He's practiced his leadership. He has perfected his techniques.
Right.
He has seen a wide cross-section of the young Marines entering the force. He knows how to talk to them. He knows how to address them. He knows what they respond to. Now he's ready to be a squad leader.
But he's at the 8-year.
So we're going to put him through.
He's at the 8-year mark, though, right? Isn't he?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Eight years.
When is he
molding?
Okay. So when is he? Where are we relative to promoting to staff sergeant? When are Marines being promoted?
So we're looking at promoting staff sergeant around 10 years.
Okay.
Which is a drastic change. From what a lot of your listeners are probably used to.
Young.
But what we've done is we have increased the level of responsibility to the sergeant, and we've also increased his pay. So if it's a question of responsibility and pay, you know, hey, we got to give them the staff sergeant so they get paid more and they have more responsibility, well, we've already done that. We just moved it more into the sergeant ranks. And we're paying him for his skill sets, and we're paying him for his increased responsibility. So we have met, you know, maybe one of the counter arguments to keeping someone a sergeant for so long. And look, it's not unheard of in the Marine Corps. Back in the 80s, how long did it take to make staff sergeant? How long did it take to make sergeant? In the 70s.
It didn't happen quickly. There was a lot of angst in the Marine Corps over the fact that other services promoted much quicker than we did, and as a result of promoting slower, you had guys chomping at the bit, if you will, to be. Yeah, for instance, I can remember when my corporals were waiting to pick up sergeant. When they put on that rank, they were beyond ready to be sergeants. They were pissed. They were pissed off corporals who knew they could be sergeants, but Marine Corps wasn't ready to promote them. And that wasn't a bad thing because they learned. They were professionals. They knew what the role of discipline, and so I don't think it was a bad thing.
Absolutely not. And we're going to make this Marine a sergeant at 4 years. But we're not going to give him a squad until 8.
Wow.
So we're investing 4 more years of literally training a squad leader through that Marine going through classes and then that Marine doing practical application at the School of Infantry as a squad leader, except it's in a controlled environment, and he's got a staff sergeant and gunny there to help mentor him in his leadership styles, and he's able to practice his leadership. He's able to practice teaching. He's able to practice communicating ideas in a way that somebody is able to respond to it and learn from it. I mean, these are not easy skill sets that we ask of our young Marines.
Right.
They're hard.
Right.
And there's some tenured professors, I would argue, that probably still struggle with it. So, yes, we are going to slow it down at the sergeant level. And we're going to put them at 8 years before we even give them a squad. But we are investing in this individual. And that's the idea behind the incentive pay is, look, we recognize you're going to slow down. We're going to pay you for it, though. We're going to make sure that your dedication and the sacrifices you're making for the organization are duly rewarded and recognized. And I think that's very important because it's owed to them. The last thing, though, that this sergeant is going to have to do before he takes a squad is go through a brand new course, one that doesn't exist in the Marine Corps right now, or doesn't exist in DOD. It's called a Joint Forces Close Combat Leader Certification Course. And what the article calls for is it to be 14 weeks long. And I don't get into details about it, but what this is designed to do is to be the red flag or the top gun of the infantry community, whether that's Marine Corps or Army. So we're going to take this Marine sergeant who's ready to be a squad leader, and we're going to send him to a joint school where he's going to work with recon guys, with SEALs, with MARSOC, with Army 11 Bravos, and a 14-week course that solidifies not only that small unit leadership capability, but exposes them to the other services and how they problem solve, how they operate. So now we start to build even more of a network at the small unit level to work together on the joint battlefield. And we're now able to cross-pollinate ideas across the services through the various small unit leaders. And it would only be small unit infantry type leaders. To again enhance this individual's ability and enhance this individual's knowledge. When that Marine passes that, we certify him a squad leader. We send him to the fleet, and we unleash him. And we let that Marine build brand new Marines and corporals who have gone through the early pipelines of training, who are already at a much more enhanced place than what our junior Marines are at right now. So now we're starting to see even more intangible, potentially intangible benefits. You think Hazen would be as prolific? Do you think your accountability would be as big of an issue? Do we think...
I'll just give you my responses to that is none of that stuff exists. And it's interesting to talk to guys who've been in the Marine Corps or been out of the Marine Corps for a while and say the strong platoon sergeants you know or the strong squad leaders that you know, if they told the gifted in a squad, don't touch our new joins, right? We don't do that. Did that ever happen? And they just laugh, like, no, why not? Because he would have your ass. If he looked at you and told you that, and you defied him, I wouldn't even want to think what would happen to you. It simply wouldn't happen. Because there's so much respect placed into that guy.
Absolutely.
And as opposed to a weak leader, you know, who probably wouldn't even look at you and say that, you know?
Right.
And he'd probably look at you and say something like, well, we all know we're not supposed to. Okay, everybody got it. But that's a lot different from a leader looking everybody right in the eye and saying, all right, eyeballs, everybody look at me. Right? They're going to be welcomed into this unit. Okay, we're going to teach them. We're going to make them better than they are. Right? And we're excited about having them here. Everybody got it? Right? Yes, Arden. All right. Let's go. They'll get here in an hour, right? Let's make sure the rooms are cleaned up. Let's make sure they're, you know, we're ready for them, and they know we're excited about having them on the team, right? Completely different. But when strong leaders say that, they don't get touched. They don't get touched.
And you know, there's also a vetting process to this model. The ones who don't want it, and want it for the right reasons, they're going to fall out.
Right.
The ones who wanted, but wanted for the wrong reasons, are going to get found out. And the ones who make it to the squads, there is going to be instant respect and credibility because everyone will understand the work that they have put in for it. And also, now we've got the squad leader who is not only way smarter, way better trained, and oh, by the way, better equipped to deal with the different types of personalities in the squad to train those Marines, especially the ones who may be struggling. But he's also sacrificed so much and worked so hard for this position, he's not going to dare jeopardize it from something so stupid as, you know, getting drunk and PTing a Marine on a Saturday night. Because he's earned it. He's earned it in a way that is not always earned now. And again, there are more Marines out there, good than bad, but unfortunately some do get promoted that have not fully appreciated the awesome responsibility of being a team leader or a squad leader.
Right.
And that's where, as you said, you know, those weak leaders come from, and they don't value it.
No, and the process that you're talking about, you're not going to be weak and get through those schools, get through that training, and really what you're talking about is creating a professional by the year 8 mark. He's either going to become a professional or he's going to be found out. All right, we have
Absolutely. All right, we have
5 minutes, and then we have to take a break. Talk to me about the rest of his career. So that gets him to the point of staff sergeant. Does this process simply repeat himself as he goes to the fleet? And does he ever get a break from being an infantryman other than when he goes to school?
So staff sergeant is where we start to allow a little more variance in the model, because we want to start broadening the staff NCO to different aspects. So the staff sergeant can go back to the school with infantry to be a platoon commander. He can go be an instructor at the joint school. Go make other instructors at the schoolhouse. You know, working through some of those schools that we were talking about. Or he can decide, hey, I want to take a crack at recruiting. I want to take a crack at embassy. I want to go do something else. I want to go work other parts of the MAGTAV and whatnot. No harm, no foul. We open the career path up a little bit more to broaden the capabilities of the squad, of the staff sergeant. He will have to pass the fourth gate, though, before getting back into the infantry. And that's the infantry unit leaders course, which we try to send all of our staff and COs to now. Either if he stays on the infantry path, we send him to that school and then send him off to SOI to be an instructor or to be a platoon commander. Or if he decides to go somewhere else and do something else for a couple of years before coming back to the fleet, him and them route, we put him through that course. That way it refreshes him, it snaps back to the infantry, it introduces him to new concepts, introduces him to new technologies that might have come about while he was away. And he comes back, does his platoon sergeant time. If he picks up gunny, put him into that company gunny. Or we can put him into the, you know, assistant ops chief position. And so forth and so on. So the current model kind of levels back out after we've gotten through that platoon sergeant and squad leader billets.
Right.
And here's the thing. Here's what I really want to highlight from this career path. The long-term benefit, okay? So if every single Marine goes through this, that means that every single squad leader in about a decade, okay, about 10 years from now, every single squad leader, every single platoon sergeant, and every single gunnery sergeant will have gone through all of this training, all of those instructor courses, all of those vetting processes. Now imagine what that does for the company, for the battalion, not just for the squad. When your company gunny was the guy who went through the entry-level year training and went through all of these steps, and the knowledge and the wisdom that he can pass down to the squad leaders and platoon sergeants who are similarly going through that training and how they can relate to it. Instead of potentially having a company gunny show up that just came off of recruiting, and oh, by the way, he went to recruiting as a sergeant and completely bypassed platoon sergeant, which happens. So that's what I want to stress is the long-term impact of the investment and what that professional brings to the group of professionals who have gone through the same thing.
My guest, Major Chad Buckle, we're talking about raising the bar on professionalism in our infantry, non-commissioned officers specifically, and staff junior staff non-commissioned officers specifically in this pipeline. All right, Chad. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk about the 15-man rifle squad. So don't touch that dial. Major Chad Buckle, United States Marine Corps. More of him coming up next right here on All Marine Radio.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network. before, but I'm not exactly why. But that music is, like, really good for hate. It makes me feel it. I don't know about you, but when I hear that, yeah, my blood notices that. Anyway, joining us again, Major Chad A. Buckle, United States Marine Corps, who's working in Brussels. The Chad, first of all, what's the A stand for?
Anthony.
Oh, that's not bad. That's not bad.
No. It's a full name.
Yeah, I know. Some guys get crushed. Like, my middle name's Francis, so it wasn't legit until we got a Pope named Francis. So now they're like, what's your middle name? Francis, like the Pope. That means it's that means it's legit, sweetheart. Don't call me sweetheart. Sorry about that. Sorry about that, Staff Sergeant. I'm just kidding. I don't do that. we've been talking about a series of articles that Chad's written, but today we're going to talk about the 15-man rifle squad. We've been talking about the infantry career path. And I think if you can't tell from the first two installments of this series, what we're talking about is raising the bar on the professionalism of the infantry occupational field. And so it's an extremely interesting case, and we're going to switch gears here a little bit and talk about the 15-man rifle squad. And so Chad's going to make a case for this. Now, Chad, did you have anything to do with, were you involved in any way, shape, or form with Sea Dragon 2025, or where did your conclusions come out, where did your conclusions come from for the 15-man rifle squad?
So I was not involved in Sea Dragon 2025. I have read extensively the AARs and many of the interviews that came out of it. And to some extent, those opinions are reflected in this article, although I do disagree with some of them, and I talk about that with the article also. But really, my idea for the 15-man squad came out of my time in Afghanistan. As a platoon commander, I was covering immense amounts of territory, and the squad was the go-to unit, as it often is, to go do patrols on its own. And what I found is that when you have the full TO squad, it's pretty effective, but if you can add a few more people in there, especially like a designated marksman, and somebody to actually, you know, work the comms for the squad leader so he can fight the squad, not fight the radio, that kind of keyed me off to, okay, maybe now that we're adding more technology and we're expecting more capability out of these young leaders, we need to give them not only more assets in the field of equipment, but more assets in the field of people, and specifically train people to do specific jobs for them.
Now, it's interesting. It's interesting that you would arrive at that number. All right, walk us through in terms of the 15-man squad. Where do you start with it? Do you reverse engineer? And I found it interesting in listening to you in a previous one of these that I did with Chris Bronzy. He made a comment when he was in Ramadi in 2004 that what they found through operation was the minimum size unit that they could go out in Ramadi was a reinforced platoon, because it had to be able to fight for 30 minutes before anybody was going to get close to them, because we weren't using artillery or aviation ordnance inside, you know, Ramadi at the time. So you were on your own, and you better have enough ass to go ahead and fight for a while until somebody can get to you. Otherwise, you're screwed. So it's kind of interesting. You make a very, very similar comment in terms of, you know, what it can do and how it needs to be configured in order to sustain itself for a bit in those kind of dispersed operations. So
it's interesting you say that, because I served in Ramadi with 1st Battalion, 6th Marines from 2006 to 2007, and that is absolutely accurate. I never left the wire as a platoon commander without two squads and a QRF teed up, ready to go, because it was, you're right, I mean, once you make contact, you're on your own for a while, and it was your organic fires versus that enemy's organic fires. So I absolutely concur with that assessment. But what I'm going to do is, you know, to answer your question, I'm going to tie first back to the first two articles.
Okay.
And then I'm going to talk about the history of the Marine Rifle Squad very briefly, so that everybody understands why we're at the current construct. Because if you don't understand how we got to where we are, you're not going to understand how we need to evolve. So the first two articles, I talked about, as you say, professionalizing the warrior and really creating this Marine, this close combat Marine, this warrior, into, you know, a world-class athlete. I use the NFL as examples. I use Olympics as the examples, you know, and the dedication that those individuals put into their sport. And then with that, the talent of that individual brings to a team of talented individuals. And that's what, that is the genesis. All right, 15, 30, 600, 2, it doesn't matter the size of the squad. If you don't put the right talent into the squad, then it doesn't matter. So it's, you know, it's very important that that we understand that the talent management and the training to get the right Marines into this team is critical.
Okay.
Because what we're going to do when we enhance the squad is we're going to make these individuals be responsible for so much more than what they are now to enhance the lethality of the team. So the next thing I want to focus on is kind of how in the U.S. and how in the Marine Corps the squad came about. So in case, and I'm a history nerd, so forgive me for the next 30 seconds, but in case we didn't, and your listeners don't realize, until 1867, squads didn't exist. And it was General Emory Upton who instituted a new form of tactical employment. And he brought the smallest conceivable unit down, first to the battalion level, then to company, and then down to, administratively, an 8-man rifle squad. And it was mainly for administration because back in the Civil War, you know, you fought shoulder to shoulder and muskets and whatnot. We've all seen the movies and read the books. So the squad started off as an administrative in-camp, care and feeding, tents, things of that nature, construct. During World War One, we went in with the 8-man squad. And much to what we just talked about with Ramadi, we realized not big enough. And it became a 16-man section. And in that 16-man section, we introduced the automatic rifle. Alright? Now, it's interesting because when we talk about this, the manning of this and what we saw in Sea Dragon 2025, we in the Marine Corps like the BAR, and we have replicated that into the IAR, the automatic rifle. And it's the greatest thing because it was awesome in World War II, and it did all this great stuff for us. But I'm going to ask you, do you know why we had BARs and the Germans had light machine guns?
I'm trying to think. Do I know what's the reason that they had light machine guns and we had BARs?
Why did the Germans field light machine guns and the U.S. decide to field BARs?
I don't know.
Because our industry couldn't make a reliable light machine gun.
That's what I was going to say.
That's it. It's not because it was superior. It's not because it's better. It's not because it's lighter and it's better in the assault. All these other reasons that we hear now for getting rid of the SAW and replacing it with the IAR. It's because our industry couldn't build a reliable light machine gun. Keep that in mind when I go back to the weaponeering of the squad.
All right.
So we get out of World War One. We go into World War Two. And the Marine Corps, through its testing of amphibious operations, started off at a 9-man squad and moved it to the 12-man squad. And towards the end of World War II, we finally settled on the 13-man squad, with three four-man, quote-unquote, fire groups and three BARs. Now, what I've kind of glossed over this is that the machine guns used to be their own section. And due to experiences in World War II, they became organic to the platoon, the weapons platoon. It used to be outside of the platoon. And we still kept the BARs, again, through World War II, at the squad level because, again, we couldn't produce a reliable light machine gun, unlike the Germans and the Japanese. So we get out of World War II, and we settled on the 13-man squad. And we went through this evolutionary period of trial and error from 6 to 16 to 9 to 12 to 13. And this is all wartime experience and amphibious operations that was driving this. And by the time we come out of World War II, the Marine Corps says, hey, 13-man squad, 3 4-man, quote-unquote, fire groups, what we call fire teams now, and we got the ARs sitting inside of each of them. So that's kind of the history of the squad, and I'm going to kind of touch on all those things as we go through and we break down how I think we can retool and re-engineer the rifle squad to be successful in the 21st century.
All right. So since since the 30s, now, okay, I'm going to ask you, here's a quiz question.
Okay.
All right, Mr. Squad Historian.
Yeah, right, stop the jump now.
The what battle is the battle in the Civil War that Upton employs dispersed tactics? It's most noted for it. First one. Battle of?
The first battle or the most famous?
The most famous. The most famous initial fight. Now, there's other minor ones, but the most famous initial fight is?
I would, and I'm venturing a guess here because I honestly don't know, but I would say the first time that we saw dispersed fighting and skirmishers was in Northern Virginia. And it was probably, oh man, I'm not even going to step a guess. I'm not.
Spotsylvania.
I'm not, because.
Spotsylvania. He had.
Spotsylvania, okay.
Right. He had, when you look at the lethality of, you know, the rifled musket, you know,
right,
the numbers of casualties that you see in the Civil War are phenomenal. Close order tactics that were developed for muskets, and the rifled musket makes those tactics obsolete. But for whatever reason, we stay in those formations. And there was a lot of arguments about conscripted army, and that's how you had to do it, and things like that. But the casualties, just, you know, the numbers are mind blowing when you look at the casualties of places like Gettysburg, the Battle of Franklin, you know, like Antietam, bloodiest day in American military history, was that day, and it was this evolution between weapons and tactics, and as Chad, you know, he's talking about, you know, the more lethal the battlefield gets, the more you have to spread out. So no, I'm a geek too. I like that stuff. But Upton, when you brought Upton's name up, I remember Spotsylvania. So. So interesting stuff. No, and the history of the squad is interesting. If you go back and you look at the different variants of the FMFM 6-5 as it evolved, talking about the Marine Rifle Squad, you'll see all those. You'll see all those changes written about. And also the other places, the digital archives of the Gazette are a fabulous repository of articles about squads and platoons and why things change, written by guys, you know, after battles and things like that.
I pulled most of this from the historical, the Marine Corps Historical Society, and there's a treasure trove of information on the real reason why we evolved the way we did, and not the
mythology.
You know, Right.
Right. No, and I'll tell you what, that's what's really, the Gazette is incredible, and those different archives are incredible because, you know, guys write, and they explain things, and they're using pronouns like I, he, we, not they, and, you know, so-and-so says, it's the first-hand account, right, and his thoughts after the battle, and I don't care what you're researching, the Gazette archives and our historical archives are awesome. Are awesome.
Yeah.
All right, keep going.
Okay, so now what I want to do before we even, again, touch the 15-man squad is I want to look at our operating environment. Because through my research, the one thing I realized is that the Marine Corps didn't arbitrarily change itself because some guy had a great idea, wrote an article, and ended up on the radio. Right? They changed their ways because their operating environment fundamentally changed and required the organization to adapt. Right? It's basic evolution, adapt or die. So, right now, and I'm going to talk in very general terms, right now, what we see is that most of our challengers, all right, you look at China, Russia, Iran, North Korea, you know, ISIL, you name it, you know, non-government, violent extremist organization, they all have one fairly loose but common trend. They are preparing to fight Western militaries, namely the United States. When they do their case studies, when they do their PME, when they, you know, do their online training and whatnot, they are focusing on the biggest dog in the yard. Conversely, the biggest dog in the yard, and let me back up, they're also planning to do that on their home turf. Right, North Korea is going to fight in North Korea. China is going to fight in and around China. Russia in and around Russia. They understand that they're not expeditionary militaries to the extent that the U.S. is, but they're regional militaries. So they all have the advantage of home field and the advantage of focusing on one type of enemy, namely a Western military, particularly the U.S. The United States has a much different problem, because we have to be able to fight a Hezbollah fighter in southern Lebanon with the exact same Marine and the exact same equipment as we have to fight an insurgent in Iraq, an Iranian Revolutionary Guard off the coast of Iran, a Russian soldier along the eastern border of NATO, a North Korean in the mountains of Korea, or Chinese Marines in the South China Sea. That same Marine with that same equipment has to be able to fight very different organizations with very different equipment sets, very different goals, very different standards of training, and we have to make that work. That is not an easy task. And you can't do that effectively if you don't account for the fact that the operating environment exist in that context. We're not fighting just the Soviets now. We have to be ready. Again, our 1980s model that I mentioned before was designed to fight one enemy. Now we have to be able to fight multiple different types of enemies who have all been preparing over the past three decades to fight us. Very, very different dynamic from what we've seen in recent decades. The next thing we've got to look at in our operating environment is that every single one of those enemies is looking to fight us asymmetrically. They are not going to go Fallujah with us. They're not going to do Desert One. They've learned those lessons. All the dumb ones are dead. So they are going to leverage technologies, off-the-shelf technologies such as small drones, GPS jammers, you know, commercial radio jammers, you name it, to hit us where we are weak so that they can offset our capabilities. And when our technology starts to fail, which it will on the battlefield, it does in training, so it probably will on the battlefield. When the radios stop working, we need to ensure that the smallest unit that's going to be in contact is organized, is equipped, and the personnel within it is trained, and then that organization is trained together as a team sufficiently enough to be adaptable in all those environments against all those enemies instantaneously. Otherwise, we're setting them up for failure. So that is the genesis of the first two articles and why the 15-man rifle squad construct that we're going to talk about today exists within these rankings.
All right. Got it. I'm tracking.
All right. So, future squad. All right. Here's the argument. 15 Marines. 3 fire teams, 4 Marines each. Sounds familiar so far.
Correct.
Difference is we're going to have a headquarters element within that squad of 3 Marines.
Okay.
All right. Every single Marine, well, not every single Marine, the majority of the Marines, the riflemen, we equip him with the IAR. We give him automatic weapons fire.
Okay.
If you want to say he's going to waste ammo, I can quote a lot of history that says that doesn't actually happen.
Okay. I'm not going to say that.
All right. And you put suppressors on those weapons. All right, so our signature reduction is part of this, is reduced. Our audible signature reduction, or our audible signature is reduced.
Right.
We equipped the headquarters element with M4A1s, same weapon that our snipers carry. Again, suppressed weapon. It's an M4 close-in personal weapon system, and it's automatic.
Okay.
The Grenadier, all right, whether it's the M203 or the M320, again, put a mounted on an M4A1, and we maintain a Grenadier, not the team leader with the grenade launcher. Team leader needs to fight the team, not the grenade. It's a trained Grenadier. And then we reintroduce a light machine gun. All right, and we'll talk about that, and I can hear some of the gunners turning the radio off right now. we reintroduce a light machine gun. We also introduce into this squad counter unmanned systems. So the ability to blind or jam drones, whether they be airborne or ground. We reintroduce the personal role radio. I had PRRs in Iraq, and those things are far superior than the 123s we play with right now. And we introduced down to the fire team level UASs. Okay? So that is the construct that I'm arguing for. We were talking previously about Sea Dragon 25. Big experiment the Marine Corps did, and a treasure trove of information came out of this. And they looked at, 14, 12, 10 Marine squads, and they, I think you had mentioned to me at one point, up to like a 17 Marine squad. I mean, they just looked at various constructs.
Right.
And one of the findings they came out with that I absolutely agree with is that the M27 should be the Marine Infantry Service Rifle. It's more accurate. It's got an increased rate of fire. It's got a cleaner operating system. It's a superior weapon, and I agree that we should be giving that out. They also talked about the M4A1 being instituted into the squad, and again, I agree with that. That automatic weapons fire is important to gain and maintain fire dominance in a close battle. Absolutely critical. There are some areas where I disagree with those findings, and primarily I'm going to focus on the decision to take away the light machine gun and why that was that's a flawed decision and why I think we need to rectify that.
All right.
So let's start where I like to start, people. So if you remember the pipeline, we now have what I'm going to just use a little term here, super sergeant, right?
Right.
We've been through this training and vetting thing. He's leading this thing. And we have corporals who have been through advanced schools and at least one deployment that are running the fire teams and are going to act as the squad headquarters.
Got it.
So that squad headquarters is going to consist of that sergeant, a corporal assistant squad leader, and a designated marksman, another corporal. All right. Both of them, along with the squad leader, are going to be JFO qualified. So we will have three JFOs and a squad. Okay?
Just a footnote. Tell everybody what a JFO is.
Oh, sorry. So a joint fires officer. So it's a person who has been trained to bring in and direct fires.
Yes.
They're not allowed to clear air, but they do know how to call in for close air support and then an airborne SAC or the SAC, you know, back at the CP can clear those fires.
Okay.
Which, when we talk next time, when we talk about companies and platoons, we're going to have JTACs at the platoon level, but we'll say that for another day.
All right.
They're also going to be incidental radio operators, IROCs. So IROC is a course that our Marines, our communications Marines, put on for infantry types. It's to teach them how to use the Harris radio. It's a great program, especially if it's done and taught properly. The ability of a small unit to communicate is life or death. And it's how we command and control. It's how we bring resources to bear, especially fire. So we're going to make sure that those three up top are extraordinarily savvy with their comm equipment. So the assistant squad leader, he's going to be JFO certified, he's going to have that radio, and he's going to carry the squad UAS. The idea of matching all that together is that this assistant squad leader, if the squad leader says, hey, I want to recon, you know, over that hill, I need to see over the dang hill. Okay, he puts the UAS up, he puts it over the hill, he sees something that, you know, he doesn't like, he wants to take it out. Instead of having to bother the squad leader, he can take that squad leader's intent, and he can get on the horn, because he's got the radio, and he can call for fire, because he's JFO qualified, and he can take on those deeper threats, being a relative term for a squad. And this matching of training, this matching of technology is going to be the common theme to bring a capability to the squad. Right now, the squads can kind of do that, except it's only the squad leader having to do call for fire. If the squad leader is on the horn, is on the radio calling for fire, who's fighting the squad? Who's maneuvering the fire teams?
So let me ask you this: why is the squad leader calling in this mission? Why did he fight a squad and the platoon commander or platoon sergeant calling the fire mission?
Who says the platoon commander or platoon sergeant is in the right position to call in that mission?
Okay, so why is he calling it in?
So if I am doing operations in a urban environment, or I'm doing operations in a wooded environment.
Okay.
My dispersion may be close enough to where me as a platoon commander, I can help bring in fires in support of my squads. Or I may have a squad that is outside of my audible range or outside of my visual range that is in contact, and that squad leader may be better suited, or that members of that squad may be better suited to actually bring in those fires. If we want to have this distributive operations concept, where we have squads that are capable of semi-autonomous operations, right? Squads that can go and take the fight to an enemy, or if they get in a compromising position, they have the knowledge and the resources and the weapons to fight that situation. Then we need to be able to disperse decision-making, and we need to be able to disperse fires down to that level and not rely on the platoon commander. So that is the argument for this.
I've got a problem with
that. Will a squad ever fight alone? We hope not. But I bet we can find plenty of examples in the last decade where that has happened.
The problem I have is is the coordination of that with other units. It's not as simple as calling in the target. It is, where are the other two squads? Do I know? Right? And so it's a complex.
It's a complex issue. You're absolutely right. Here's what I would offer back. That same problem set of where are the two squads? Do I know? Exists with the platoon commander. Where are the other two platoons? Do I know?
Yeah, absolutely.
And the answer would be you better dang on know where your adjacent is.
Right.
So then if that's the answer we're giving to a lieutenant, and we have now invested all this resource to building this super squad leader, this super sergeant, then that expectation can now be placed upon him. Because he's not with his ear to the radio, because he has somebody to do that for him, like we do at the platoon level, and because we have trained him and we have invested in him to be able to think, to be able to react, to be able to read a battlefield, read its effects, and understand it, smaller scale, but still do that, then he better know where his adjacent is. Maybe he's the lead squad in a movement to contact, and he's in the kill zone. And while the other two squads are deploying, the enemy's jamming radios, or the enemy is, maneuvering on the other two elements within his platoon. And he has the opportunity to bring down organic 60s from the company onto an enemy position. Should he have to radio back to the platoon commander to do that?
No,
Doesn't the company have the ability to, a company can clear its own 60s, so it can help deconflict, just like we do at a battalion level.
All right, I'm skeptical. Just so you know, continue. I'm skeptical.
No, that's hey.
Because let me just tell you,
I'm all about dissent opinions because it forces someone to know their argument.
It's easy to talk, but when people are getting dead, and I'll just give you a stupid example. When you're instructing at the basic school and we're using blanks, and we're doing butter jam, the enlisted instructors are out there. And all of a sudden you go bump, pop, 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 and all of a sudden this uncoordinated flanking attack takes place.
Uh-huh.
Right? We've all seen it. We've all lived it. Okay?
Yep.
If I made this announcement before we did anything, hey, I'm not sure exactly where they're at, but just to let everybody know, there's three live rounds mixed in with your blanks. Okay, and we're not using BFAs anymore. Okay, so we have some other magical kind of around. Just so everybody knows, I'm not sure where they're at, but somebody got them, so be careful. There would be no uncoordinated flanking attack. There'd be pop, 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 like everybody would get their ass down, right? Like, hey, let's do a flanking attack. Hey, why don't you shut up, okay? Flying lead, as you know, has that effect. So I just
yes, it does.
So so the coordination piece now takes him out of fighting the squad. Who fights the squad now? As he becomes a fire support guy.
Well, but he's not. Again, if we give him someone who can. Who has been trained and who has the equipment on hand and the knowledge of that equipment, much like a fire support team at a company level, except one dude, okay?
Right.
To identify targets and help to prosecute those targets in coordination with that squad leader's actions, I think that's value added. Let's turn this into a different context. Let's say that squad has been assigned as a support by fire position. For a platoon assault. Okay, so they're going to provide support by fire while the other two squads breach and assault.
Yeah.
All right. If that squad leader has the light machine gun, and he has, you know, a UAS capability to be able to put it closer to the enemy positions and find where that's at. And he has a trained individual who can call in the fires accurately and quickly on those positions. Is that not value added to the platoon commander? Because then the platoon commander can help focus on the breach and the assault and the maneuver in the other two squads.
Yeah, no, absolutely it is. I just... he's going to fight his squad and do fire support. It's just, as we all know, anybody who's tried to do that, you know, when your head goes down to the map to make sure the right people get dead, you know, somebody else better be managing that event in front of us, or else it's not going to go well. And so, okay.
And here's the thing. You know, solutions are never... are never 100% for every single problem, right? So if we're envisioning every time there's contact, we're going to throw a Raven or whatever and then call for 60s, then we're missing the point. The point is to, one, again, we've trained these individuals to be thinkers and not, I'm up, they see me, I'm dead. We've trained them to be able to read situations, and we're resourcing them with capabilities that they can match to the problems that they face, which will be vastly different from anything I can imagine right now. And that's the point. How do we resource to the lowest level responsibly the ability to bring the fires of the MAGTAF to bear, so that as the battlefield disperses and the units get smaller because lethality of the battlefield increases, we are still able to bring that lethality without having to reach back unnecessarily for support.
Got it. All right.
Okay.
I didn't mean to screw you up.
To you and to your listeners, I am all about somebody calling me and emailing me and saying, "Bull, don't work. Here's why."
No, I'm not saying bull. I like pushing as much forward as we can. It's just hard. If you've ever done it for real, it's hard.
Yeah.
To coordinate.
It's very hard.
It's coordinate to fire support. And when you, if you expect that of him, now he can report the grid and all that kind of stuff and say, hey, here's what I need in terms of effect on target. But then he's got to get back to the fight or else. And this was my point as a company commander. If I'm doing your job, who the hell's doing my job? And doesn't the company need me to do my job? The answer to that is, yeah, it sure as hell does. Because if nobody's getting the company commander, that's a problem. So I need you to be up to snuff, full up round, and I need your replacement and his replacement to be the same thing. So you got to get to the gym, and you got to work out. And I don't mean just physically. I mean mentally. I mean tactically. I mean fire supportedly. I mean all those leads. You got to do all those leads. So I'm with you. And again, I'm not calling bull, but. I will, just to make the caveat that's a difficult piece. That's not an easy piece.
Absolutely.
Okay, keep going.
All right, so the other guy in the headquarters, a designated marksman, again, something we had in Iraq, major value added. He carried the same weapon we did, so in this construct it would be the IAR, except as a more powerful optic. And the reason why I like... having a designated marksman is somebody who is able to take longer shots and slow down and take out those critical targets, because, you know, as an enemy digs in and fortifies, the target picture of the top of the head over the machine gun or the parapet gets smaller. As we fight in urban environments, sometimes there are going to be civilians mixed in with the enemy. And if we have the opportunity to take out key leadership, take out key weapon systems, or take out really bad dudes hanging out with people who, you know, don't want to be there. Again, we want to give that capability to that squad leader. Is he always going to be, you know, doing the sniper thing? No. And that's why he has an IAR, because he can still, you know, go to full auto and fight with the squad as required. But having that precision capability, again, I believe is value added, especially in an urban environment. The other thing that we would equip this guy with is a counter UAS weapon. All right, and what this is it's a they've got these things on the market. Battelle put one out called the Drone Defender. I don't know what the right answer is technological wise, but the concept is if there's a drone flying over your head, it jams it, it forces it to land, and it's of zero value to your adversary. Now, why do I want this in the squad? Well, let's look at Ukraine. If you're familiar with the Ukraine and what the Russians did to the Ukrainian army, you will understand that the enemy has very effectively, especially the Russians, matched UAS to indirect fires. And as with all the things I've quoted without the source material in front of me, I'm going to probably misquote this a little bit, so I'll warn your listeners. But I think it was something around 10 to 12 minutes from when the Ukrainian soldiers would hear a UAS to when artillery, accurate, massed fires were landing on their position. And it was devastating because they had nothing to blind, nothing to take down the Observer, which was a commercially purchased unmanned aerial system. So, again, we're going to look at that operating environment as the battlefield becomes more lethal, and we have to disperse in order to survive. We also have to deal with the enemy's eyes and his ability to put a UAS out there and have that, I mean, the battery is controlling it, so as soon as they see it, they grid it, they shoot it. And it had absolute devastating effects. So starting at the squad level, we want to start having the ability to affect those systems that are going to register us, target us, and then ultimately kill us. So that's the headquarters.
All right, I'm tracking.
Okay. I'm going to move on to the light machine gun. All right, so We're gonna take a look at the IAR real quick. It can deliver very accurate automatic weapons fire, but it can do so at 100 meters.
Yeah, where did you get that number?
Full auto. I pulled that, and I'll have to find. It was a fact sheet. I believe it was a fact sheet on the weapon system itself, or it was a study done on the weapon system that it's extremely accurate at semi-automatic at distance, but when it goes to full auto, that accuracy gets walked back to about 100 meters, and I would have to get back to you on I'd have to go through all my research and find the exact article or the exact reference point for that.
Okay. All right. No, and here's why I asked that. Guy who's a battle buddy of mine times three, who I respect to the world, said that's not accurate. So anyway, I brought up the article just probably a month ago. And Gunner Mike Musselman, I don't know if you know him, awesome guy, one of the smartest guys I've met in the Marine Corps, and does the full range of military operations. He can talk it, he can think it, he can teach it, he can do it, and he can lead it. Anyway, so he just has to say, where is that footnote? Because my experience is that's not accurate. But anyway, having said that, go ahead, keep going.
Okay. No, hey, fair enough. I mean, I will certainly go back and take a look at that if that's inaccurate, and I'll correct.
Okay. No.
I can't do it in the article, but I'll come on your show and I'll correct it.
No,
issues with that.
I told him I'd bring it up. He wanted to know where he said. He asked me. He said, "Could you just ask him to footnote that?" And I said, "Absolutely, I will." So anyway, all right, keep going.
Okay. So the other thing I want to look at is some of the studies that the U.S. military and the Marine Corps have done in the past on small arms. So March of 1969, an article titled "The Optimum Organization for Marine Rifle Squad" was written. All right, and it was, and it essentially said that the present squad is organized on three fire teams built around a single automatic weapon. That those Marine Corps squads currently in combat in Vietnam, all fire team members are armed with automatic rifles. And that 85% of all Army small unit leaders questioned during an infantry rifle unit study project believed that an organic machine gun was required at the squad level. So again, we're back in Vietnam where we had the original version of the M16, which was fully auto. So the automatic weapon was proliferated throughout the squad. And even though that model existed, overwhelmingly, members coming out of Vietnam believed that we needed a light machine gun. Okay, but that's not empirical data. That's, you know, that's interviews.
Okay.
So let's go to the year 2000.
All right.
Where the Center for Naval Analysis published a report, Development of the Squad, a historical analysis. It's a great report if you ever get a chance to read it, and you want to nerd out like I do. And it noted that in 1946, at an infantry conference in Fort Benning, that the Army was unable to field an effective light machine gun as a replacement for the BAR. We talked about that already.
Right.
And that proved a weakness within the European theater for fire maneuver. And that the squad was not equipped appropriately to deliver suppressive fires as they would have been with a light machine gun. That the automatic rifle did not provide the requisite suppressive fires when chasing a peer enemy. Rifle fire, even if automatic, is inadequate. It also found, that same study, found that in Korea, the squad lacked firepower because it did not have an organic light machine gun. The BAR did not have the firepower of a light machine gun. So we learned in World War II and in Korea, fighting peer enemies in a conventional battle, that we needed a light machine gun and not an automatic rifle, that the automatic rifle just wasn't getting the job done. And consequently, we went to the SAW, the M249, Squad Automatic Weapon.
Okay.
And we possessed that. Oh, man, when did that come online? In the 70s, I think?
No, 1985.
85, holy moly. There's a gap in my knowledge.
Ask me how I know, because I took it overseas for the first time ever.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, Charlie Company 1-5 deployed in February of 1985, and we took it. So probably 84 it was fielded, and we took it with us to Okinawa, and then we left ours there. That's how the 3rd Marine Division got theirs, was rotating units would take theirs and leave them and come back and be replenished in Kona. So
nice.
Yeah.
So we now we've looked at World War II, Korea, Vietnam. Automatic rifle, not doing the trick. We need something more. I think if we look back on our experiences and we learn from our history, we can conclude with confidence that removing the light machine gun out of the squad, out of the fire team, and going to an all-automatic rifle construct, although, you know, the argument for it is that it is lighter and you're more maneuverable and all this other stuff, the firepower that it brings is an advantage that we are depriving ourselves of.
Well, I will just tell you my personal experience as a second lieutenant. Before we got the M249, we essentially did what was done in Vietnam, which is we had bipods for our M16s, and the automatic rifleman had his weapon on auto, and that's how we employed it. The M249, compared to that, with its larger capacity magazine, well, actually, it's the drum magazine and the bipod, there was no comparison in terms of the ability of the M16 to compete with the M249. Wasn't even close. So, yeah. So I vote for the M249.
Okay. And now what I'm going to do is I'm going to say, hey, the M249, it's not the weapon we need right now. We need to evolve that light machine gun. And again, I don't, there are way smarter people that deal with weapons than me, but I'm going to put out one example that addresses the weight argument against the M249, because the M249 is heavy when it's got a full load, no doubt. The Army has been testing, or has a program that has tested the lightweight small arms technologies, LSAT, light machine gun. All right, it's a Textron weapon system. I pulled one of their fact sheets. I have no way of validating whether any of the data is accurate or not, but I assume it is, because I have nothing to refute it.
Okay.
The LSAT is 9.4 pounds empty and 19.1 pounds with a 1,000-round load.
Okay.
All right. The M249, with its full load, is somewhere in the neighborhood of 31 pounds. So right there, we've already cut the weight.
Okay. And so what? You cut it 11 pounds?
About 11 pounds,
okay.
Which is, I think, any grunt would argue is fairly significant when it's just sitting in your arms.
Yeah, substantial. Absolutely.
The IAR is 7.9 pounds. So, you know, it's obviously the light machine gun is going to be heavier, but there is a weight reduction for... With newer light machine gun technologies, and I'm sure there's other ones out there that are potentially better than this one. Again, I kind of use this as an example. There are technologies out there that have light machine guns that are lighter than what the 249 is, but still deliver the range and accuracy of the 249 along with the volume of fire. And that's the point.
Okay.
Volume of fire means something in suppression.
Absolutely.
All right. Sea Dragon 2025 also looked at proliferation of unmanned systems onto the battlefield.
Right.
And we kind of talked about this. One of the ideas that I would like to float out there is that with the proliferation of unmanned aerial systems, the more that we can disrupt that and the more that we can deny the enemy access to those systems on the battlefield, the more survivable our Marines are, period. Whether it's a fire team, a squad, battalion, regiment, division, MEF, whatever. So one of the things that we would look at doing is taking, at the fire team level, issuing out to one member of the fire team, pick your guy, an islet. Infrared, zoom, laser, illuminator, designator, an islet.
Okay.
Right now, we have this in our inventory, and our FACTS and JTACs use it to illuminate targets. It weighs about 25 ounces, it's about 14 inches long, has a range of 43 kilometers, puts out 950 megawatts of energy. That's pretty good to point at a target for an aircraft to shoot at. Again, I'm not a scientist, but I'm fairly certain that if I pointed that into a camera, I would blind the camera. So if there's this thing buzzing around my position about to bring in artillery on me, and I'm able to blind it, it may not be permanently, but I'm able to blind it or I'm able to disrupt it, that is a plus for me. That is something that I can tangibly use to defend myself against a new weapon on a battlefield.
Okay.
So, between that and the, you know, a radio signal disruption type device at the squad level, we now have the ability, potentially, and I'm not a scientist, so, but what we want to do is create the ability for the squad to defend itself against an emerging weapon system, because we're not the only ones putting machine guns on unmanned systems. We're not the only ones putting 81-millimeter mortars on unmanned systems, or missiles, or rockets. So we now have to have the ability to defend against these assets, these weapon systems. The next thing, personal role radios. So right now, a squad communicates one of two ways. It does hand and arm signals when it's snooping and pooping through the tree line, or they yell at each other in the middle of a fight. Neither one of them are particularly effective. For hand and arm signals to work, you always have to be looking at your buddy. If you're looking at your buddy, you're not looking at your sector of fire. And then if you've ever been in a firefight and you're trying to yell even 3 feet away to somebody else and the noise of all that, it's pretty much, you know, an exercise of futility. Yet we have, in the past, equipped our squads with the ability to push and talk at short distances, but we have now taken that away. I've been told we've taken that away because it's unsecure nets and the enemy can tap into it and they'll hear your conversations and all that stuff. I don't know if that's the real reason. And if that is the real reason, I would argue that, okay, you want to listen to my squad conversation, you're not going to figure out my battle plan. You're going to listen to a bunch of dudes cussing at each other saying go left or go right. Not a lot of discernible intelligence is going to come out of that. We currently use the PRC-153 radio. And it's a decent radio. It's a little bit big, a little bit bulky. The problem is in all my time in the fleet, I've never seen a headset that works with it. And
still an issue.
So, I'm sorry.
Still an issue. As of last week.
Good. So now you're
most of the time you have a handset, right? It's going to
right.
Okay.
So now you're sneaking around, right? You're Johnny Recon. You're creeping up on the enemy. He doesn't know you're there, and all of a sudden, bloop, battery dying. And oh, by the way, he knows I'm here now. Just not the right radio for the infantry. Maybe for a gun line or for, you know, inter vehicle communications, but not for guys on the ground. A personal role radio with a headset that's got dual channels and basic encryption on a UHF frequency that can talk through the urban environment will allow for a connection, a physical connection between the leaders of a squad and the lead within the squad. It will allow for a junior Marine who is covering an alley that sees something to be able to communicate that without either turning his head to yell it or just sitting there wondering how he's going to communicate it without getting shot. It will allow for, you know, team members who may be pinned down in the kill zone to have somebody to reach back to and tell them, hey, bub, keep your head down. We're coming. Whatever. It allows for communication, which is just huge and vital when you're in a life and death situation. And I think it's a shame that we have not equipped our close combat forces with that system. And then the last thing that we'll look at is down to the fire team level, so fire team squad level unmanned systems. So there are drones out there that, you know, can sit in the palm of your hand, weigh an ounce, have a camera, and can provide you some pretty good video feedback. At the fire team level, that's exactly what these Marines need. Something they can throw into a room, throw into a bunker, throw into a building, and just see what's going on. It doesn't need to be long-range reconnaissance. We're talking about close-in reconnaissance. I run up, I'm putting my stack in, I throw my hand grenade through the door. I throw my throwbot into the door. It drives down the hallway. I see the machine gun. I know exactly where the enemy is. Small flying nanobots that can go into the second deck to make sure that that's clear for entryway, or can fly up the stairs to see if there's somebody waiting for you up there as you try to go through that funnel. These small systems at the squad and fire team level, when properly employed for close-in reconnaissance of a close objective, can literally be lifesavers. You know, you've fought in an urban environment. Many of your listeners have. You understand that in those tight quarters, when you can't see around the corner, sometimes you just guess. And we should be able to take away that guess. We should be able to give our Marines something that can look for them so that they understand the threat posture of the enemy as they go into that room, go up those stairs, into that building, go into that bunker complex, trench line, whatever. And they're cheap. They are consumable, and they are, I think, on the modern battlefield, essential to giving our close combat units an upper hand in maneuvering on and defeating an enemy. And at the squad level, we'd get a quadcopter. Same thing you can buy at Walmart. And you know, these things are pre-programmable. So you can have it go fly a certain flight path to cover dead space. You can have it go look at, you know, over a ridgeline, look over the next block in an urban environment, you name it. It's got day-night capabilities, most of these things, civilian models. And you can often put some kind of designator on there so that you know a grid location, or you know its location, whether that's direction and distance from yours, and you can discern a grid. Again, close-in reconnaissance for the close-in warfighter who needs to just throw it up quickly, look at something, and then be able to take action on that something without exposing himself to enemy fire. That's what we're looking for. That's what we're calling for. And that's it.
So, give me a summary of our new squad now. So, we got three fire teams of four.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, we got the rifleman's got an IAR. The grenadier's obviously got his weapon, right? And then M4s for the fire team leader. And are we still calling that guy the assistant automatic rifleman? What are we calling the fourth guy?
We're calling him the light machine gunner.
Okay. No, but what about? Okay, so we have the light.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So the rifleman and the assistant automatic rifleman.
Okay.
We can call them that. Would have IARs.
Okay.
The light machine gunner will have a light machine gun. The fire team leader will have an M4 along with the three in squad headquarters. We're looking at personal role radios. We're looking at counter UAS capabilities. We're looking at our own UAS capabilities down to the fire team level. We're looking at enhanced, obviously, the training and skill sets that these Marines bring. And we're looking at, you know, an updated radio suite that allows them to communicate in a denied environment.
All right, and the thing that so when you look at these capabilities, the only thing that makes them go is you got to get these guys back to school. You got to make them professionals in their craft so that they can employ all these systems in consonance with movement. Right, and so it's, again, what you're talking about is a higher form of infantry. Yes.
Yes. So, technology. Look, I am not a technologist. In fact, my computer crashes when I look at it. I'm pretty certain our next battle plan is to drop me into China so that all of their technology fails. Technology, I don't get along. Okay. But you got to understand that you've got to bring in and match technology capabilities. But you do that after you have trained the warrior. You know, technology enhances the warrior. The warrior doesn't enhance technology. You build a widget for the warrior. You don't build a widget and then make a warrior for the widget. So yes, we're talking a higher form, but it starts with the training.
All right. My guest has been Major Chad Anthony Buckle. And we've been talking about the 50-man rifle squad and the capabilities that will go with it. And so it's been an interesting little 45 minutes here. What do people need to know about this squad before I let you go today?
So let's go back to the train, man, and equip concept. If you are going to create a better trained individual because you realize that in the modern arena, the old training doesn't work. If you're going to train a better trained individual, you have to give him an organization that unleashes that talent, that unleashes that new capability, that allows that individual to thrive, to think, to innovate. And that's what this new construct is all about. It's not an arbitrary number. If you want to make an argument for 30-man squad, I'll go there with you. As long as, at the end of the day, the organizational construct and the equipment provided to the warrior allows the warrior to be unleashed upon that enemy, allows the warrior to thrive, allows the warrior to be adaptive and to do the things that we have trained and need that warrior to do. That's the salient point. Everything else is academic.
Okay, so once you commit to that, then everything else is simply deduced logically from if this, then this, if this, then this. If this is the modern battlefield, then this. Everything else is logical.
Yes, and here's the other thing. If you change the warrior, and that forces you to change the squad so that it best fits the new warrior, then you got to change the platoon. If you change the platoon, you have to change the company. If you change the company, you have to change the battalion and the regiment and the division and the MAGTAF. Because at the end of the day, if you believe that the center of gravity, the hub of which all Marine Corps power comes from, is the rifle squad, the base unit that accomplishes our missions, then when you create or when you change that organization, you have to adapt all the other organizations to equally support and unleash that squad. It's symbiotic. But the squad is better and takes on some of the roles of the platoon, which we talked about, right, with fire support.
Right.
You're taking on some of the roles of the platoon. Then the role of the platoon has to change to enable that squad, to enhance that squad, to better support that squad. And if the roles of the platoon changes a little bit to support and enhance the squad, which is built to unleash the new warrior, then you got to change the company a little bit to enhance and support the platoon, and do the same with the battalion, and so on and so on. So it's all linked. It's a symbiotic relationship. There's no patchwork here. It's got to be a logical thread from the individual to the MAGTAF commander, just like commander's intent, just like end state. It's got to flow up and down the chain.
My guest, as I said, Major Chad Buckle, and we're talking about his argument for the 15-man fire team and all the stuff that goes with it. So, Chad, first of all, I appreciate you taking time again to make us smart about your thoughts. And then next time we get together, we'll cover two more articles. What are we going to cover next time?
So we will talk about first off, the company, and that will encompass what we're going to do at the platoon level and at the company level to best support these maneuver elements, platoon supporting his squads and the company supporting his platoons. And then we're going to talk about, at the battalion level, what changes, again, that I believe we would need to institute to create more lethal maneuver units and more capable organizations.
All right. You heard it here first. So whatever you do, don't touch that dial. You're gonna hear that probably not the next week, but the following week. And as Chad graciously gives up his little bit of his time to talk about the things he's written about. So, Chad, first of all, tremendously impressed by the thorough nature of the work you've done. And if you can't tell, I mean, from Emory Upton to the M249. I enjoy the conversation always because this is the kind of stuff that I think as professionals, it's our moral obligation to engage in and to try to make it better and push the product. So thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you for having me. I thoroughly enjoy the conversation, and I welcome it with anyone.
Got it. All right. More of All Marine Radio coming up next.